Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 104. I'm Wolfgang Dasha. We're continuing our uploading of presentations from the Ontario Association of Child and Youth Care Conference, which took place in June 2017. We're starting with presentations from Educators Day. This year, we had students and system-involved young people present to educators in attendance. We called the session, Learning from the Educated. This week, we're featuring two short presentations, one by Simbal Mohammed and the second by her twin sister, Aisha Mohammed. Simbal and Aisha spoke about being Muslim students, their decision to start wearing a hijab while in the program, and facing white privilege as religious and racialized students. I trust you will find the program informative and challenging.
Good morning, everyone. So first, I would like to thank Wolfgang for giving me this opportunity to speak here, and Charlotte as well, because she pushed us to come out and speak here, because I wasn't as confident as coming on speaking, but she said that we should. No, it wasn't pressure. It was a good kind of pressure, like encouragement. So I don't want to take too much of your time, but my name is Simbal Mohammed. So the first thing I want to talk about is my name. So it's written Sunball, but it's actually pronounced Simbal. It's another thing that I struggled with, I think, my entire life. And that's already something that is different because of who I am and the culture I come from, that the name is written differently in English and it's written differently in my language. And for some people, it's like, what's the big deal? Like, it's just a name, like, relax. But I think it has to do with your identity, right? When somebody pronounces your name correctly or not correctly. And so when professors say, hey, like, can you let me know how do you pronounce your name? And that really feels good, because they care about how I want to pronounce my name. So my name is Simbal Mohammed, usually seen as Sunball Mohammed. And like I had funny names in all through high school, Sunny Balls, Moonball, all that.
But actually, I was Moonball.
She was Moonball. We're twins, by the way. So I recently graduated from the Bachelor of Child and Youth Care at Humber here, which was a month ago. Feels much longer. Yeah, it was an amazing experience. And I'm here to share. I'm here to share some of that experiences with you as a minority. And I have had both positive and negative experiences in this program, honestly speaking. And I am here as a racialized and a very visible religious minority. So in the field of child and youth care, majority of the literature and like the treatment plans and practices come from a more Western perspective. And so this means that often people writing those literature programs, treatments, are people that are white. And in terms of being a minority in this program, I realized that my voice, strategies, or ideas sometimes were not validated, both by faculty and students, because of who I am as a racialized person or as a religious minority. So as a Muslim, because I am a Muslim, my religion is Islam. And it's like people looked at me that there's always some kind of bias in what I spoke, like if I spoke because of my religion or culture. So my words weren't just taken as like a professional or something like that, but my religion and culture was always associated with it. Whereas one of my very close friends, she's white, and we had a conversation, and she agreed that when she spoke out, it was never that way. Her religion or her race or her culture was never associated with what she said. It was just her as a person. And in conversation with the same friend, we both agreed that I was always more hesitant and careful of what I said, because I'm a Muslim, and what comes out of my mouth, I have to be very careful, because it's taken a certain way because of who I am. And she agreed. And I want to actually thank that friend, because we have those kind of conversations. And you know, it gives me confidence to know that other people agree. And it's not something that people like me just get up and always complain about, this is what's happening and no one's hearing my voice. But I want to thank her for that. So I was a little bit hesitant to speak at times during class discussions or, you know, other things that happen within the community. And that's not me. I'm not the kind of person who likes to, you know, shy down. I like to talk and have discussion. And I would say I'm a very outgoing person. And so when that happens, it was a little bit disheartening. And as I said, I recently graduated. So if I felt like that as a student, that I can't speak how I want in a class discussion because of who I am as my identity, then going into the field, that's like, it bothers me. It scares me because now that I'm going into the field as a professional, which sounds scary because, I don't know, now I'm the adult that's responsible. And I don't have as much confidence in my abilities because of my religion and my identity. And although I may have great abilities in the work I do, there is barriers for me now because of my religion. And that bothers me. And I think that when this lack of confidence comes, your clients and consumers pick that up. They see it. They can see when you're not confident because of a certain thing. And that is not the kind of message that I want to pass on to any of my client or consumers, that your religion, culture, or any kind of other identity is going to impact the way people perceive you or not take you seriously or not actually validate what you're saying. That's not the kind of message I ever want to pass on to any of my consumer or client. On a positive note, I want to share my experience of wearing a hijab. So wearing a hijab is a requirement of my religion. However, it's still a personal choice. And I think a lot of people don't know this, and it's important for me to bring that up here today, that nobody forced me to wear this, and it was a personal decision to wear it. And in fact, in the first 2 years of this program, I did not wear my hijab. And in the third year, I decided that I wanted to wear the hijab. And this was a time of fear and discomfort because of all the Islamophobia in this in our communities. I was a little bit afraid to wear my hijab, and I didn't know what the response would be. But I did wear it, and I have to say that I was amazed at the response that I received from students and faculty. I don't think anybody saw that hijab on me. Like, at one point, they just saw me as that person I was in first and second year, and that really gave me a lot of confidence, because then I realized that the people within this program didn't care about what I was wearing on my head. And I don't know if that has something to do with child and youth care programs, because we're more empathetic and caring and accepting, but I would like to think it is. But it was a really good experience, and that response that I received is something I will carry with me for the rest of my life. Because had I gotten a negative response, I don't know what I would have done, or if I don't know, I probably would have gotten mad at all my professors and like taken it personally or something, I don't know. But and I think that when faculty, and especially like professors, when they create that kind of atmosphere, when you're able to come out and be open about anything, promote your like identity in any way, it's amazing, and it helps students learn in all aspects. And it didn't just help me form identity. I think any other person who's coming out in these kind of ways, it will help them form their identities, which they can then continue out in their professional life. And interestingly, one of my close friends now, she admitted that if I had worn my hijab on the first day of classes, she wouldn't have approached me the same way. And that was really interesting to me, because she said, I didn't know anything about Muslims, and there was just that fear and discomfort about what those people that are Muslims are. And so I just want to leave with one note here, that all I would ask for people is to just ask and listen then, what people's religions are, what their race is about, what their culture is about, or what their anything is about. Like, if you don't know, just ask. And there's discomfort in asking as well. But I think I would rather have that kind of discomfort than people just assuming and creating an environment where people are not able to even speak out about who they are and what their identity is. And that's it for me. Yeah, sorry.
That was so insightful and helpful. Thank you. Can I ask you for some kind of an example of something that you might have said that you felt wasn't taken by your professor as valuable?
It's kind of hard to remember at the top of my head. It's a good question, because you're right. Like, I should bring out specific examples. In terms of like treatments that are more Western-based, like that come from a Western perspective, if I shared something that I thought could help another family from my background, for example, it was seen as if they knew more than me because of the perspective that they had. And it was like, it's true that you're the professional, but at the same time, I do have some advantage. Not all, I still don't know that full story either, because everybody's experience is different, regardless of how many similarities there are. But if I do have some kind of similarity with that person, like in terms of religion or culture, and I feel that this might be helpful, I may have been like, not shut down. I don't want to say I was shut down, but it was more of like, yeah, that could be a possibility, but the best way could be this.
So what would have been a better response?
Well, asking like, oh, like, how do you think this could work? Is it because you come from the same culture, or what is it? And then, oh, that's interesting. We can bring that up and try that out in that kind of situation in the future.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? No? Okay. Okay, so I guess it's me next. So as she mentioned, we are twin sisters. So my name is Aisha Mohammed. Mine's a bit easier. And I also just graduated from the Bachelor of CYC program, as mm-hmm. expected. Finally. I kind of miss this place, though. But so I want to share that I also had a tremendous experience in this program. Like my sister, it was one of the best experiences of my life, and I'm very grateful to Humber and all the professors that are here today. But I just want to give a round of applause to my professors that are here. And I'm not sucking up. I already got the mark, so. but I'm going to say that I do have a tendency to talk about things that make people a little uncomfortable, because I think it's good to be uncomfortable. I think it's good. So that's what I'll be doing today. So I want to start off by talking about white privilege. Yeah, I said it, white privilege. I think we can all agree that white privilege is a real thing that does actually exist. However, there are some things about white privilege that we do not actually think about consciously, but I have observed them in my 4 years that I was here at Humber. So I just want to share with you those things. So firstly, what I want to share is that I've noticed that if a professor of color or student of color brings up the topic of white privilege, the responses that they get is very different from their peers and professors than the responses they would get if they were white. So what I'm basically saying is, if a professor who is white brings up white privilege, there's a sense of there's more people are more comfortable with it within the environment. But if a professor specifically of, and I've noticed this in my program because we have a few professors who are of color, when they brought up the topic of white privilege, the responses from the students in the classroom were pretty negative. So it was as if because they're not white, they're not allowed to bring up white privilege, which is white privilege in itself. Similarly, I want to talk about who decides to talk about white privilege. So, like I mentioned, if a white person wants to talk about white privilege and wants to talk about it, then it's okay. Then we can have that conversation for sure because they're okay with it. They want to have it. But if a person of color wants to have that conversation, it's up to the white person whether that conversation is allowed in the room or not. And so the power in that conversation is still to the white person in the conversation. So whether it's a professor or student, it doesn't really matter. That the power dynamic is not about the professional and the student, but rather about the race. So I think that's something that I've really noticed, which is interesting, because like I mentioned, if white privilege is about the white person deciding who can talk about it, then that's contradictory to actually talking about white privilege in the first place, mm-hmm. right? So my point of bringing this up is not to say that white privilege is a negative thing, because realistically, we all have privilege in one way or another. Although I'm a minority, I have privilege because I am able-bodied, right? So I have privilege over other people. So we all have privilege. So it's not to say that white privilege is necessarily a negative thing. But I think the most important point that I just want to bring out is to remember that I think it's not just enough to acknowledge that white privilege exists, or that, you know, yeah, it's here and it's present within our community, but to talk about how it is discussed and understood within our education system, specifically the post-secondary education system, and who we really allow to speak about white privilege. So I think we should make it a more open environment and allowing people to speak about white privilege without giving a negative response. Or, I mean, we sometimes act like, oh, no, like it's all okay, and anybody's allowed to talk about white privilege, but in reality, from what I've noticed, I don't think it actually is like that. So that's just what I wanted to bring out today. That was it. Because she mostly covered what I wanted to say, so I couldn't really copy. So. Thank you. If anybody has any questions? No? I guess I made everybody uncomfortable. Okay, we're going to go.
Sure. So I think it's really interesting that you're able to bring that up, and thank you so much. Being a white person who wants to be an instructor in a post-secondary classroom, how do I bring it up in a way that's also acknowledging everything you've just said? What would you recommend?
Well, I think the main thing is, like, when you have people in class discussions, like, when you have students who are of color and students who are white, and you're bringing up a topic, that when they give the when two students are given the response, that your response is the same to both of those students. Mm-hmm. Because you may think that it's the same, but people will pick up if it's different, right?
Yeah.
So maybe work on it. It's like a personal thing to work on, right? Like, there are some things that I know I need to work on, and I've been trying to work on it at home in front of the mirror, like for today. So I think it's important to work on it like at a personal level at home first, and then bring it on to the professional classroom in that way. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
You have to know how to be an ally. Yes. Allyship is important as a white person. You have to know your power and your privilege, right? So that's critical. If you're going to engage black and racialized students, you have to know your privilege and how to speak on that privilege in the classroom.
Do you have any recommendations for tools or readings or
after?
Watch your presentation.
There's two more questions, and then we'll move on to
questions.
Colleen and Carrie, I think, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so one of the things that I think, as a white faculty member with privilege, is that when I walk in my classrooms, all my marginalized students are sitting in the back of the class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I often will point that out right away. Because there is also, now some people it's just a comfort. I mean, we all have our space, but I think there's also a belief as well that I often will open up those conversations right from the get-go because I want to point it out and notice because I don't want that kind of classroom. I don't want people, if you want to be in the back because that's where you're comfortable, that's okay, but a lot of times that's not why people are in the back.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's having those difficult conversations that you bring
forward. Thank you. Thank you. Is there one more question?
So I feel like you guys just scratched the surface and you have me so intrigued and you're so insightful and so deep about those two things that you just brought up that I'm interested in. And I'm really excited that the field gets to have you guys, so
you.
I hope you keep going with this.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And I want to ask, they are presenting at the conference, a full 90-minute workshop.
Our workshop got canceled.
Our workshop was actually canceled by the OACYC.
Yeah.
It's really disheartening.
Not enough people signed up for our workshop.
Yeah, so it got
canceled.
I don't
know what that says.
The
topic of my workshop was visible minorities becoming invisible.
So,
and not enough people showed up, so it was actually...
That kind of sucks, but yeah, I got canceled.
Speaking truth.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.